Journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is the Daily Circuit. Good morning. I'm Tom Weber, along with Mark Sadeklik. This hour, here's a question. What if we never run out of oil? We're going to dive into that provocative question later this hour, Mark.
And Tom, right after the news, we're going to take a look at some of the legal implications of that landslide in Wednesday in St. Paul that killed two kids. But first, this update of regional news. Governor Mark Dayton has signed the so-called legacy bill, laying out the spending of the state's sales tax funding for the outdoors and the arts. It includes a provision that will ban the use and sale of coal tar. The thick black chemical has been used in the past to seal asphalt driveways and other surfaces. The compound includes cancer-causing chemicals. Sealants have been shown to wash off and accumulate in stormwater ponds. That's forced local governments to send dredge material to expensive, hazardous waste landfills when they do routine maintenance on their ponds. State Representative Rick Hansen, a DFLer from South St. Paul, says the state ban follows 33 local government bans on coal tar.
We felt this was the time where we could do this preventive action to reduce the amount of polyaromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, in the environment by instituting the ban.
Alternative coatings are available. The new ban takes effect next year. The nomination of Minnesota U.S. Attorney B. Todd Jones to be the next director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has advanced. Brett Neely reports.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will hold its first hearings on Jones's nomination on June 4th, after Congress returns from its Memorial Day recess. President Obama nominated Jones to the post in January as part of his push to step up enforcement of gun laws after the massacre in Newtown, Connecticut late last year. But the nomination stalled due to Republican concerns about Jones's management style and Obama's gun policies. Jones currently splits his time between serving as Minnesota's U.S. attorney and as acting head of the ATF. If he's confirmed by the Senate, Jones would be the agency's first permanent head since 2006. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
And in another sign that the summer tourist season is upon us, U.S. Customs and Border Protection says its Ely inspection station will open for the season tomorrow. The border station is located in the National Forest Service Complex in Ely. It serves people arriving from Canada through the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Tom, that's an update of regional news.
Mark, just this hour I'm watching Tim Post, a reporter here at NPR. He's out in St. Louis Park. There's a memorial for the two children who were killed this week. Governor Dayton is speaking out there as well.
He is. Questions are being raised about the safety of St. Paul's Bluffside Parkland following this week's landslide and the two deaths. St. Paul officials are trying to determine what happened on Wednesday when a landslide occurred at a popular fossil hunting spot. Could the tragedy have been prevented? Should someone have known better than to allow the kids into the area given the amount of rain that's fallen? Attorney Harry Sieben joins us this morning from his office in Minneapolis. Good morning, Mr. Sieben.
Good morning.
What are you thinking about from a legal perspective as you look at what happened earlier this week at Lilydale Regional Park?
Terrible, terrible tragedy. I don't know if there's any liability on any part. There may not be. If somebody was negligent by not seeing the warning signs and not warning people, somebody that had the ability to do it, not warning people away from a dangerous area, there's certainly the possibility. The next question, I suppose, would be, well, did the victims or the parents of the victims or the school on behalf of the victims sign a waiver of liability? That comes into question whether waivers are enforceable or not. In fact, the legislature just last week was working on the issue and passed legislation on whether waivers are against public policy or not. So there's a lot of unknowns, and I'm happy St. Paul is taking the steps to find out what went wrong, certainly to prevent future occurrences, but also to find out what went wrong in this instance. And I'm sure by their past practices, if they made mistakes, they'll step up to the plate and say they made mistakes. But I don't know if that's the case.
I wanted to talk about the waiver issue, but I first want to ask you just about the sort of act of God clause that we see in a lot of insurance policies and other things. Talk a little bit about this. Does this look to you sort of as though it would sort of fall into that category, that this is just an unfortunate, terrible tragedy?
Well, it is an unfortunate, terrible tragedy. And an act of God, meaning the rainstorms, if they did cause this or contribute to it, the nature of the soil or the rock or whatever was on the hillside being an act of God, sure. But if it was foreseeable that this kind of event could occur, and somebody knew it, somebody in position that should know it, somebody either knew it or should have known it, and should have warned against it or roped it off or whatever is appropriate, that trumps an act of guard, act of God defense ordinarily. So it's sort of a broad category. It's an act of God, yes, that that the weather occurred, but there's other factors also.
Attorney Harry Sieben is on the line this morning from Minneapolis. We're talking about the landslide that took the lives of two kids earlier this week in St. Paul. I have a couple of kids, and Mr. Sieben, it seems like once a week I'm signing off on a permission slip or a waiver for them to do this or that. When I do that, am I signing all my rights away, or what am I doing when I say, you know, I won't hold this person accountable as one of my children heads off on a field trip, not unlike this trip that these kids were on?
That's a very good question. Most people sign those waivers just because they're put in front of them. Are they enforceable is the question. What do they read? What do they say? Most people don't look at them or don't understand the significance, effort on behalf of the people that provide the waivers is to avoid any liability exposure, even if they do make foreseeable mistakes. Now, that is sometimes against public policy. The legislature addressed the issue recently because of the increase in the number of waivers that everyone like yourself is presented with in our course of our life. When your child comes to you and says, I'd like to go on this field trip, but you have to sign this waiver, and people sign it. Is that against public policy? Are the waivers enforceable is the question. They're not always enforceable, but sometimes they are. And it depends on what they say, and it depends on who the possible defendant is, whether it's a government agency or a private party. It's easier to break a waiver as against a private party than it is a government agency. So there's a lot of unknowns, and I can't answer the question very directly.
Attorney Harry Sieben's on the line. We're talking about the landslide in St. Paul this week. In this case, Mr. Sieben, the school apparently signed off on the fossil dig waiver, not the parents. What issues might that raise? Sign off for the parents?
Right. I suppose the school is... No, I don't think the schools can sign off for the parents. I suppose what they were doing is saying that the school won't make claims against the city. I haven't seen those. I don't know that, but I would imagine that's what it is, that the school is saying they're not going to make claims against the city in case something bad happens. I don't think the school can sign an enforceable waiver on behalf of the parents, but the school may have waivers from the parents. When the kids want to go on a field trip or the teachers encourage the kids to go on a field trip, many times they'll send a note to the parent saying, we'd like to take your child on a field trip. You got to sign a waiver saying you're not going to make a claim against the school. Everybody wants to be exonerated from their liability or their mistakes, whether they're intentional mistakes or not. After it happens, it's very rare when somebody steps up and says, yes, we made a mistake, and we are accountable for the consequences of our mistake. It's more often the case that they'll say, first, we don't think we made a mistake, but second, even if we did, here's a waiver that says we're not responsible for our mistakes. So these waivers are not a good thing, but they're reality, and sometimes, to some degree, they're enforceable.
If they're not enforceable in many cases, why are they shopped around so much? I mean, it's sort of just a matter of fact that you sign a waiver.
In the first instance, just take hypothetically, somebody's on a water slide, and the people that are maintaining the water slide put some kind of a bolt on it that shouldn't have been there that sticks out on the inside of the water slide, and the kid slides down and rips their leg open or their head open or something like that, hypothetically. on a bolt that should not have been there. And the injured victim or his or her family goes to the people that run the water side and say, hey, you shouldn't have put this bolt there, and here's a lot of damages as a result. And the potential defendant, the owner of the water side, says, well, you signed, that may be, maybe we did make a mistake, but you got on there after you signed a waiver saying you're not going to make any claims, and we don't want you making any claims because you signed this. That's why we let you on it. Now, that is probably against public policy, but that type of a waiver, I hope it is. Again, depends on the facts and what happened and what the waiver says.
Back to the St. Paul incident, there's already a lot of reporting quoting people that are familiar with that park area and who say that it's an area they would avoid given the circumstances of how much rain has fallen, and that it's clear that there are landslides to a much smaller degree occurring there with some regularity. Does that, in your opinion, make it more likely that this is going to become a legal dispute as this develops here and moves on?
Well, most tragedies do result in a legal dispute, and this probably will too. I don't know that. And then the next question is, well, what are the facts? Was there or should there have been knowledge by people in charge that this was a dangerous condition that was about to cause a problem, or might have caused a problem, and where it should have been roped off or something like that? So I wouldn't be surprised if it results in some kind of legal action, and it'll be fact-driven on what happens. And I don't know, of course, and I'm glad that the city is taking steps to have an investigation done to try to get to the bottom of that. And we're dealing with very honorable people there in the city, and I'm sure that if they think it was mistakes made there, they'll fess up to it.
Well, Mr. Stephen, thanks for taking time to talk with us this morning. Sorry we have to have this conversation.
Thank you very much. Tragedy. Bye.
Bye. That's Minneapolis Attorney Harry Stephen Tom, and you noted when we got into the segment that the governor, Mark Dayton, is at Peter Hobart Elementary School in St. Louis Park this morning for a memorial service for the two kids.
More coverage on that, of course, all throughout the day and at nprnews.org. Let's get a check, Mark, of the other news happening this hour.
Tom, the Washington State Patrol Chief says the Interstate 5 bridge collapse into the Sagatt River north of Seattle was caused by an oversized truck. Chief John Batiste told an overnight news conference that the truck hit an overhead span. The truck made it safely off the bridge, and the driver remained at the scene and cooperated with investigators. Two other vehicles went into the water as the bridge collapsed. Three people were rescued and are recovering. An explosion has sent smoke rising over the heart of Afghanistan's capital. The strong blast was felt several miles away. An Associated Press cameraman who witnessed the blast said it was near a hospital for the State Intelligence Service. He said the blast collapsed a building wall. It was not clear if there were any casualties. Police cordoned off the area, which also houses buildings used by international aid agencies. Secretary of State John Kerry says he believes a Mideast peace deal is still possible. Kerry said today that Israel's government should prevent further settlement construction where possible to help revitalize Mideast peace hopes. Kerry stopped short of calling for a complete settlement freeze in lands contested by the Israelis and Palestinians. Criticism of the U.S. policy on drone strikes to kill Islamic militants remains strong following President Barack Obama's speech on the subject, but international reaction isn't all bad. The speech was well-received in Pakistan and Yemen, two countries most affected. Pakistan still says it would like the strikes to stop completely. That's a news update. More is just ahead on the Daily Circuit.
On All Things Considered, you can catch up on the headlines of the day from across the state and around the world and get analysis on the issues that matter. I'm Tom Cran. Be among the first to know what's next. Join me on Minnesota Public Radio News starting at 3.
Subscribe to the Daily Circuit podcast online at nprnews.org.
I'm Tom Weber. Hey, did you hear Dan Crocker's story this morning about the cabin season starting? We're collecting cabin photos and hope you'll send your images and memories on Twitter. You can use the hashtag TellMPR. I'm joined now by Charles Mann, a contributing editor at The Atlantic, who recently posed in an article this provocative question: what if we never run out of oil? The article resulted in a couple responses as well, to which Charles responded, natural resources are finite, right? Or is it just the areas where it's easy to find them finite? Better technology means we can go more places to look. So what if our demand actually can be met forever? Charles Mann joins me now to discuss both the good and bad that would come if that were in fact the case. He's in Amherst, Massachusetts this morning. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning.
Glad you're here. I welcome your questions and comments as well. 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can also tweet me at WeberTom1. We've already gotten a couple comments online on the Daily Circuit page. What should we take from that question, Charles? What are you trying to start here, I guess, with that provocative question, what if we never run out of oil?
Well, I'm suggesting that there's a long argument that has been going on for decades about whether we're going to run out of oil, run out of petroleum or not. And there's been a lot of attention paid to an idea called peak oil, which is that sometime in the 1970s, the U.S. Production of oil peaked, and sometime a few years ago, the world production of oil peaked, and that from this point on, the amount of oil that's available in the world is gradually going to taper off. And on the other side is the argument that yes, we are using up some of our oil, but technology is constantly increasing the amount of oil that's available at an affordable price. And these two sides have been arguing for decades, and the recent discovery of a whole variety of different types of petroleum, including which is the most famous is shale oil and shale gas, have, in my view, given a distinct, a decisive edge to the people who are saying, look, we're just not going to run out of oil, and we're going to have to deal with a world of oil plentitude.
And to clarify, I mean, in the biggest sense of the word, finite and infinite, there is, of course, a finite amount of oil in the world.
Right. We just don't know how much it is.
We don't know how much it is. And what you're referring to is the concept of, will our demand ever tap it out?
Yes. And what happens is that we're in a kind of a race between increased consumption, which was, of course, reducing the amount of oil that's available, and increased technological exploration, which is increasing the amount of oil that's available. And so you have these famous examples like in California, where just north of Los Angeles, there's the Kern River oil field, which has been tapped since 1899. And repeatedly people have thought that the oil there was exhausted. It was predicted that it was almost gone in the early 40s. It was predicted that it was almost gone in the 50s. And again, a few years ago. And time again, as new technology has come into play, people have realized, wow, there's more than we thought. And so the current oil field, which is just one of the examples I give, was thought to have roughly 50 million barrels in it left in 1940, and by now it's pulled out of, many, many billions of barrels out of it, several billion barrels.
So our history of predicting how much is left is not so good.
No. And it's in fairness, it's a very, very difficult question, but it's also one that's been hampered by the fact that we just simply have been, at least part of us, have been unwilling to realize how enormously powerful the combined attention of the petroleum industry is to pulling more oil out of the ground.
But what's going on here? Is the idea, is the concept that we'll never meet our demand, is that the result of, quite honestly, the technology? You talk about the technology to go get it, so I get that. So maybe our demand will never be met. But on the demand side, is that happening because the stuff we use does a more efficient job of using it, or is it that we really are more conscious and we really want to use less oil?
Well, sort of all of those. We are increasingly getting more efficient because although there's more and more oil being found, it's also somewhat getting more expensive, and so this encourages us to be more efficient. And so the amount, the per capita use of oil is leveling off or even declining. The problem is there's more and more of us, and so that means that places like China are ratcheting up their demands. Places like Japan, places like India.
So is this a good thing or a bad thing, Charles? That we might never run out of our demand or meet our demand for oil.
Well, it's both good and bad. one of the problems for the U.S. has been that since the early 1970s, our foreign policy has been in hock to the need to get more oil, mostly of it from the Middle East. And this has locked us into a kind of toxic relationship with many, many Middle Eastern states and other petro-dictatorships, Venezuela and so forth. And incidentally, the tremendous amount of clout that those guys have had, these petro-states, has not always been good for them as well. There's what's this phenomenon called a resource curse, in which something you would think would be good, having control of a vast amount of resource, turns out to be bad for their economy. And so the oil system that we have has created a lot of problems. And what increasingly you're seeing is predictions from groups like the International Energy Agency that the United States and maybe other countries as well will become something like energy independent. And that means we won't be nearly as dependent on Middle Eastern states and other kinds of petro-states. And this will, obviously, energy independence is a goal that is one of the very few goals that unites Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama. And so, obviously, this is a good thing in the narrow sense for the United States. It's a bad thing for world instability. And this is one of the ironies of all this, is that everything you say is good is also bad, is also good, is also bad, and so forth. And the piece that I wrote for The Atlantic was an attempt to try and sort of disentangle all these things.
Did you come down on one side, or are you just kind of throwing it out there?
Well, ultimately, these are moral judgments, right? Is it good for us to be energy independent when that might cause, lots and lots of strife around the world? The biggest source of the future potential, I argue, is a new form of natural gas called methane hydrate, which exists all along the continental margins. And there's just an absolutely enormous amount of this. And Japan, in recent years, has been learning how to extract it. And just a few weeks ago, finished the first commercial test of extracting methane hydrate.
This is underwater, you're talking about.
Underwater, right. About 1,000 feet underwater. And this is this fascinating stuff. Methane hydrate is where, when sediment washes off the continental margins and lands in the water and, trickles down to the bottom where it's eaten by microorganisms, just the way that the stuff that washes onto the bottom of a pond in Minnesota is eaten by microorganisms. And if you've ever walked by a pond in Minnesota, occasionally bubbles come up, and that's methane. And the exact same thing happens along the continental margins, except that when the temperature is cold enough and the pressure of the water above is high enough, the methane can't escape into the air. Instead, it reacts with water and forms this snow ice-like stuff called methane hydrate. And there's just an absolutely fantastic amount of it. There's actually estimates that there's twice as much methane hydrate as there is all other forms of petroleum in the world. And that's probably too high, but it gives you some idea of how much we're talking about.
Talking with Charles Mann here, contributing editor of The Atlantic. He has written an article. We've posted it on the Daily Circuit page as well. What if we never run out of oil? What do you think about that? 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. David is on the phone in Minneapolis. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, two things. Number one, it's frightening to me that we'll not run out of oil. I mean, the sooner we run out of oil, the better off the planet will be. When we're absolutely forced to do other things, otherwise we are dead. And this methane hydrate, isn't methane the gas that permafrost gives off? Isn't that a major pollutant?
Yeah.
Isn't that just going to add to the problem? We don't need combustibles.
Yeah. David, thanks for the comment. And Charles Mann, you allude to this as well in your article, and I think probably a lot of other people would agree
exactly.
With David,
makes
the environmental
the transition
side
to renewables much, much more difficult. If you have a huge pool of relatively affordable natural gas, it makes a transition to solar, to wind, and to the other kinds of non-carbon energy much, much, much more difficult. And on the one hand, on the other thing, on the one hand, it's very good for the U.S. economy. There's all kinds of studies showing that it would, energy independence of this sort would do enormous things for U.S. economic growth. On the other hand, just as your caller said, it makes the task of mitigating the worst parts of climate change much, much harder.
And if you do attack those methane hydrates, as you were talking about, Japan's doing a lot of work. They've spent a lot of money on it. Still way not cost-effective at all yet. It's a very new technology. But isn't at the end of the day what you're doing is releasing that methane, and isn't that an issue for emissions and well, problems
methane,
with the environment?
Methane is basically natural gas. And so I don't know if you have natural gas in your stove, but
sure.
That's methane. And so there is a huge amount of methane that's being released from conventional oil. When you buy, when you drill a conventional oil well, what you get is not like a big lake of oil that you're tapping into, but rather a whole mix-up of different types of hydrocarbon, including natural gas. And so we're doing this right now. We're releasing huge amounts of it that goes into pipes and then is burned. Natural gas burns, in fact, much, much more clean than oil or coal. And one of the big hopes is that if we do are able to produce a lot of natural gas, that we'll be able to transition from coal. And coal, roughly produces about half of, or maybe a little bit less, of our electricity, and produces just an absolutely phenomenal amount of pollutions while we're doing that, including the kinds of pollution that we're worried about. So the idea is that if we have lots and lots of natural gas, we can use that as a transition fuel to get us over the hump while renewable resources like solar and wind come down in price and become more affordable.
And there
that's the optimistic scenario.
Yeah, and there are studies, Charles, that suggest things like solar and wind continue to get more cost effective and that we might be, in the next decade at a point where they're really rivaling.
Right.
There's a good rivalry going on there.
Absolutely. And the great difficulty is that natural gas, petroleum of all sorts, produces a very, very steady supply, and wind and solar do not produce a steady supply. So in addition to getting generating costs down, which we've been very successful at, we also need to build storage and also re-architect the electrical grid to make this possible. We've just barely begun to do that.
We actually talked about the grid there a couple of weeks ago, and one of our guests noted that if we're going to bring all these new sources online, we do need to add lines to the grid, but that would be one way to do it. Charles Mann with us from The Atlantic has written an article that you can read at the NPRnews.org website. Charles, prepping for the show here, I looked over some numbers just this week from the feds that are outlining oil production in western states and how much it's increased. And here's the thing. Really fascinating. We're not looking at increases in oil production over the past 10 or 25 years. This is a graph that shows increases just since 2010. This is 3 years. North Dakota in 2010 was producing 261,000 barrels per day. Now it's up to 779. Texas went from 1.1 million to 2.3 million barrels per day. That's in 3 years. It's fascinating to think that the oil's been there the whole time. People think that fracking, though, Charles, is new. It's not necessarily new, but how does the cost of oil and the cost to drill the oil play off each other when we talk about these numbers?
Yeah, one of the reasons that this has all taken off is that for decades, engineers worked on hydraulic fracturing, or fracking as it's called, which is really a combination of two techniques. One is where you drill into the ground and you inject water or gas or other chemicals plus sand in it to pry apart these previously kind of impregnable sediments, and it cracks it open and allows the oil to flow. And the second part of it is horizontal drilling, and in this sort of amazing way, they drill down quite a bit, and then it bends around the corner and shoots sideways and catches these very, very long bands of shale and breaks them up. And this technique has been worked on since the 1970s, and it's finally just begun to pay off. And this is the kind of thing that we talk about with technology. 12 years ago, one of the reasons I wrote this article is that 12 years ago, I was asked by another magazine to write an article about oil supplies, and I talked to the engineers who were just then developing hydraulic fracking, and they told me that this was really going to pay off, and this was really going to revolutionize the oil industry, not tomorrow, but the day after tomorrow. And I was fascinated by this. And then I talked to all the pundits, and every single pundit said, don't be ridiculous. That'll never happen. It'll never pay off. And lo and behold, here we are today.
So is that your point with bringing up methane hydrates?
Right. Many of the same kinds of people were saying this will never pay off were the same types of people who said to me 12 years ago that hydraulic fracturing will never pay off. And I think, having been proven once, been proven correct once, I think we should now start paying attention to the engineers who are telling me that this is very likely to pay off.
This gets sticky, though, Charles, when we talk about the desire by people in the public to move to renewable energy and, mm-hmm. and quite frankly, the technology that's getting better. It almost seems like this question, if the answer actually is that, yeah, we're never going to run out of oil because we're never going to meet the demand, couldn't that actually be a boon to the renewable side of the argument, because the challenge then for them would simply to be making that demand so low that we don't want to do any of that drilling anymore, that it just goes away?
That is the challenge that they face. And I guess you're right that it could be a boon in the sense that it would spur them on. But, you know, in plain economic competition, what it does is it makes their job harder. If, you know, much of the country is already plumbed for natural gas. And if we get huge amounts of natural gas at a very cheap price, in the last couple of years has been just an extraordinarily inexpensive cost for natural gas, it really does make the transition to renewables much harder because the economic competition gets it. And so part of the environmental movement, in my view, is animated by the hope that if we just run out of petroleum, we'll be forced to do the right thing and to switch to renewables. And in that way, I guess the article I'm writing is saying, bad news. So, we're not going to be forced to do it. It's going to require wise public policy choice.
Well, then, yeah, how does that change then? How does that argument change? If you're coming back and saying, no, it's never going to run out, at least determining our demand, then how would that argument change to make it a good public decision, to go for it?
Well, I mean, right now, all over the country, there's a vigorous argument going on about climate change. I mean, you don't have to go very far on the internet to find people really having a tremendous back and forth on this. And if you look at the polling, it seems gradually more and more Americans are becoming convinced of the need to make adjustments for climate change and are expressing willingness to make some sacrifices to prevent the world, as they see it, from kind of falling apart in this way. And that's ultimately where the real battle is going to be. And in my view, much too much the environmental movement has been sort of hugging to itself this idea, oh, we're going to run out of oil, and so we're going to have to do this. We don't have to do this. We need to make a decision to do this.
Well, but this also gets to my earlier question, mm-hmm. as far as how we, our own day-to-day activities. One of the best things you could argue that I could do for climate change is to go out and buy the most fuel-efficient car on the market, but mm-hmm. I don't necessarily change my driving habits. I drive just as much as I did. All I did was that one thing. In a way, I really haven't changed anything. It just happens to be the vehicle I'm using.
Right. But, the cheapest car that you can probably buy is, and if you're just purely concerned about money, would be some kind of old beater that used up a lot of gas, right?
Mm, yeah.
And so what you're saying is I will, invest in a new car. Maybe if I'm wealthy, I'll buy a Tesla or one of the new electric cars or something like that. And that's the kind of individual choice that people are going to have to make. My wife is an architect, and we recently moved into a new house that we tried to make as close to net zero energy use as possible. And that's our particular individual choice. We also need, however, if we are truly going to make a transition to renewables, we're going to need public policy choices. It's going to have something that individual efforts like yours with your new fuel-efficient car, or mine with my efficient house, are not going to be enough.
Charles Mann with us, contributing editor at The Atlantic, has an article on the Daily Circuit. If you go to the Daily Circuit homepage on nprnews.org and click on this hour show, you can read the article that Charles talked about and writes about what if we never run out of oil. You can leave your comments there as well. 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Eric online says the idea will never run out is magical thinking because, yes, there'll still be oil in the ground, but it won't be used for energy. So we have effectively run out. And I think what he's talking about there is this idea of the cost of getting it out. If demand goes down, Charles, if mm-hmm. we do so much more with renewables or I change our habits so much and demand goes way down, then those oil fields you talk about in Japan or in California are not necessary anymore, right?
Right. But exactly. That's the way it would. And your writer, the person who wrote in, is exactly correct. We don't run out. We just stop using it.
Let's take a call here from John, who's on the phone in St. Paul on line two. Good morning, John. Your thoughts?
Hi. Thanks for having this conversation.
Sure.
I think that one of the problems with fracking, as well as global climate change, is that it ruins our drinking water. I mean, the sideways drilling and the blasting down of these toxic chemicals to loosen the gas from the rock and so on ends up with this kind of toxic slurry at the end of it, and it uses a great deal of water as well. And so I think we're going to need drinking water in the future a lot more than we will short-term natural gas.
John, thanks so much for the comment. Charles, this goes. He alluded to the comment you made about how just oil pools don't exist. When you bring oil out, it's a sloppy thing there.
Absolutely. Now, there has been a great deal of concern about the fracking and drinking water, exactly as the caller has said. And there's been a number of studies that have looked at that. And in general, I think that the argument seems to be that this isn't as problematic as might be initially thought. And here's the following reasons. First, most of the fracking, most of the oil deposits are way below drinking water. When we have drinking water, it's really in the, you know, in the first few hundred feet of the earth. Fracking is going down thousands of feet. So there's relatively little communication between them. That doesn't mean that there never is and there haven't been problems, but it's, and as a general rule, it's not common. And the second thing is that fracking is in as a technology is brand new, and there's now increasing experimentation with using carbon dioxide in there. And one of the fascinating things is that actually you can blast it with carbon dioxide instead of water, and this actually ends up storing carbon dioxide. So you sequester the carbon, you to some extent counterbalance this. And so the real, in my view, the real concern for fracking is not so much the water and the environmental issue, but frankly that it might be successful and might dramatically increase the amount of natural gas and oil that's available to us that will make, you know, the transition to renewables much harder.
Are there other things released in fracking into the, you know, just in that process of drilling then that also become part of the problem?
Well, interestingly, the answer is yes and no, as in so many of these things. Mm-hmm. I was very surprised to learn researching this article, excuse me, that there is really no inspections made of gas pipelines. Whether they're the big gas pipelines that take, you know, shale gas from Pennsylvania and places like the Middle West around the country, or the smaller pipelines that go into people's houses and in apartments in places like Minneapolis. And they're completely uninspected, and they leak tremendously. There's been some early studies that suggest that that we really need to pay attention to our natural gas infrastructure. And that is something that I would be obviously very, very much in favor of. There appears to be a lot of leakage there, and that's just a problem with the existing natural gas infrastructure, not so much with fracking per se.
Let's take a call now from Joe, who's in Fergus Falls. Good morning, Joe. Your question.
Hi. Appreciate the program. In general, regarding carbon-based fuels like oil and gas and that stuff we're getting out of fracking, stuff that's going to be coming out down the Keystone Pipeline, when we consider those kinds of fuels, what happens with all these extraneous costs that we just ignore? How come that cannot be included into the cost of the product so that free markets can function and alternatives will be so much cheaper that we'll wonder why in the world we ignored this concept of extraneous costs? It seems to be the economist's way of cheating. I'd like your feedback.
Charles?
Well, the kind of costs you're talking about are, you know, in economic speak are called externalities, and they are costs that are not factored into the cost of when you buy the store. And for, you know, an obvious and example of that is that when you buy, you know, a pork chop, it doesn't count the cost of the pollution that goes into the river from these gigantic, you know, pig farms that you have in places like, you know, Tennessee. And so there's lots and lots of work on trying to figure out how to add in the cost of these externalities they're not regularly able to put in. And climate change is almost uniquely difficult in that we're all making a tiny contribution to it. You know, when I turn on my car, I'm making a tiny contribution to it. When I, you know, burn gas in my stove, I'm making a tiny contribution to it. Industries are making, you know, bigger contributions to it all over the world. And then the effects aren't felt for decades, because it takes an enormously long time for the CO2 concentration to build up. And it's also not easy to remove it out of the air. And so figuring out how to accommodate these costs is, as one of the economists I talked to put it, as a non-trivial exercise. It's very, very difficult. That doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, but it's it isn't so much cheating. It's just it's really hard.
Another call here from Leo, who's in St. Cloud this morning. Good morning, Leo.
Yes, I think the parallel between the gun control lobby and gun control, even though most people think registration is a good idea, the lobby is so strong that nothing will ever happen. And the same thing with the fossil fuel industry is so strong, the fossil fuel lobby is so strong that that it'll probably never happen for that reason. Same parallel.
Charles, what did you find on that? You didn't touch on it a whole lot in this article. You were kind of more on the science of it all.
Well, you know, all these issues of lobbies and so forth are very complicated. It is absolutely true, as far as I can tell, that in the gun debate, the National Rifle Association is a very, very powerful lobby. It's quite different in the energy debate, because not only do you not have a single lobby, you have the oil companies, you have the electric utilities, you have the car companies, you have the gasoline manufacturers, you have many, many, many different players. But also, you have this tremendous public involvement in it. You know, even though many, many people say, yes, yes, we have to transition to renewables, when it comes right down to actually increasing the price they pay for electricity, people are reluctant to do it.
One last call here before we wrap up our conversation. Alyssa's in Lanesboro. Good morning, Alyssa. Your thoughts?
I just want to say that I think to really promote renewables, the thing that would really move the dial is legislative action on the federal level. And since that's not likely to happen, I think the next thing you need to do is promote the use of natural gas as much as you possibly can, because it opens up new markets for gas. You know, vehicles, for example, the export of natural gas in the form of LNG. And as those markets develop, the price of gas goes up. You know, even today, gas is about twice as expensive as it was, you know, in other words, on the NYMEX, it's about twice as expensive as it was a year ago or 18 months ago.
Yeah.
And as the price of gas goes up, the cost of renewables becomes more attractive.
And, Charles Mann, it's worth noting here in Minnesota, we are experiencing very much a regional spike where we have been as high as Hawaii and California here on the price,
wow,
the gallon of gas here for a number of reasons. So this conversation comes in that context,
right,
that Alyssa brought
up. You know, frankly, that's what it's going to take. You found Americans were just simply not interested in buying fuel-efficient cars until gas prices nudged up to $4 a gallon, and that had a dramatic change in the automobile industry. And ultimately, those price signals are pretty darn important, just as your caller says.
Yeah, we are at $4 right now, as a matter of fact. So
there that kind of wakes you up and makes you pay attention, doesn't it?
Well, and so out there in Amherst, Massachusetts, enjoy whatever it is you're paying out there.
And I don't want to tell you because it's going to make you feel bad. No, it's about $3.49.
Okay. Well, Charles Mann, thanks so much for your time here from The Atlantic. You joined us from Massachusetts. We've linked to your article, and I know it created a lot of debate online. And you came back and had a bunch of reactions and comments as well. So we'll invite the conversation there as well here. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Charles Mann, contributing editor at The Atlantic. Conversation continues. You can go to the Daily Circuit homepage at nprnews.org and click on this hour's show to comment. Mark Zadeklik now in here with Check of the Hour's News. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Tom. British police say two men have been arrested on suspicion of endangerment of an aircraft after an incident on a civilian plane flying from Pakistan to England. A jet was launched to divert the Pakistan International Airlines plane carrying nearly 300 passengers to an airport northeast of London on Friday. It was originally supposed to have landed in Manchester. Essex police say two men have been arrested and removed from the plane. Russia's foreign ministry says the Syrian government has agreed to a conference on the country's future proposed by Russia and the United States. Russia's foreign ministry spokesman said in televised remarks today that the Syrian government had agreed in principle to participate in the conference in Geneva, which is expected to be held within 2 weeks. Governor Jay Inslee says work has already begun to design detours after a partial bridge collapse in Washington State. State Transportation Secretary Lynn Peterson is asking people to avoid the Interstate 5 area for the next several days. The National Transportation Safety Board is sending an investigative team. 3 people were injured, but officials say it appears no one died. State police say a truck hit the bridge. At least 22 aftershocks have struck following an earthquake in far northeastern California that was felt as far away as San Francisco and in 2 other states. There have been no reports of injury or serious damage. Officials say the magnitude 5.7 quake broke dishes and shook mirrors when it hit last night. That's a news update. Stay with us for more of the Daily Circuit coming up next.
Programming is supported in part by our generous philanthropic partners, including U.S. Bank, serving our communities for over 145 years.
This is The Daily Circuit on Minnesota Public Radio News. Follow us on Twitter. We're at Daily Circuit.
I'm Tom Weber. Finally this hour, thinking outside the box or the bus. Daily Circuit producer Chrissy Pease recently visited with a University of Minnesota architecture grad who is turning the definition of house on its head.
His name is Hank Butita, and he turned an old school bus into a house. It was for his master's project, and last week he presented the project to professors and professional architects, and I tagged along. The tour is really quick. I mean, it doesn't take much time to go through 225 square feet.
Right.
But collapsed into this wall system, in addition to the insulation, you have a blackout panel system, so you can keep light out, because with all these windows, there'd be a lot of light.
And then the critique started. There were about 20 of us on the bus, and U of M architecture associate professor John Kamazi noted that Hank's project is perfect for millennials, a generation that moves around a lot because they can't find long-term jobs. I mean, let's not forget, Tom, it's not just a house. It's still a functioning bus. So here's what Hank had to say.
I think people in that position, they don't want to be permanently in this kind of space. I think this works well as a transitional space. I don't know if you'd want to raise a family in here, but it can get you by, you know. You can exist without probably rent and mortgage, and you can be flexible with what city you're in additionally.
Okay, bus and house. Where do you park this thing, Chrissy?
It's a great question, and Hank actually answered this from his own experience. You see, he bought this bus off of Craigslist, of course, for $3,000. And before he was able to convince the architecture school to let him park this thing for the semester on campus, he had to find streets and neighborhoods that were cool with having an old gray school bus parked there for about a week.
A lot of this is kind of only possible because it's not really explicitly addressed. You have to find friendly neighborhoods, really. If you find people who are acceptable, who don't complain, then you can pretty much stay wherever you want. But if you have neighbors who are displeased, they could probably get you kicked out. You can park up to 72 hours on like any city street, but as soon as someone says get out of here,
the RV community has figured this whole thing out.
Yeah,
they know where to go.
I mean, Walmart's a temporary option, but like those,
they're actually quite permanent. They're not permanent, but they'll linger for a while, and Walmart understands that they benefit from that because they're buying all the supplies there.
Okay, so take me inside this bus home thing.
Sure. Well, to begin, you enter in the back of the bus.
Oh, okay.
So right now it's incomplete. You would walk into the bathroom area. There'll be a shower and a composting toilet. That's not done yet, but that's what will be there. You'll then go to a kitchen area, to a sitting area, and then the sleeping area. And again, doesn't take that long to get through the bus. Hank has designed it so it can accommodate 6 adults. You know, it's really not for tall people. I mean, you have your limitations because of the size of the bus. The ceiling's only 6 feet tall.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that, you know, Tom Fisher, who's the dean of the architecture school, who was here for the critique, he's about 6'2", 6'3". When that shower's put in, I bet it would be uncomfortable for him.
Not an issue for you, though.
No, I'm only about 5'5", and frankly, you know, we had 20 people on, and, you know, we were only in there for about 45 minutes, but it felt roomy. I don't know if it's that we're outside, and you've got all the windows from the school bus still intact, So there's light coming in. There's breeze coming in. It was quite pleasant to be in there.
So it was $3,000 for the bus on Craigslist, of course. I imagine there's some other costs. I mean, what's Hank doing to afford all of this?
Yeah. I mean, that was a big question. I asked him about financing. He said his grandfather's loaned him the money for this project. He spent about $7,500 so far. So like you said, you've got $3,000 for the bus. And then Hank said he spent between $4,000 and $5,000 more to get it to where it is today. But like I said, Tom, it's not finished.
I'd like to kind of keep the pace up with a few things to kind of finish out the framing of the cabinet and maybe even the framing of the bathroom space. But it may be a few years until the systems really get fully fleshed out. Probably a system a year, like, okay, let's get the propane hooked up and get a heater in here because winter is miserable. Okay, let's get a toilet in because I'm tired of going to the outhouse. So it could be a while before it's fully fleshed out.
So he estimates this is going to cost him at least another $5,000.
Well, but still, I mean, that's 12. So you've cleared $10,000, but at the end of the day, you get a home and a bus.
Yeah, I mean, that's the entire point of it, you know, bringing it back to the appeal for millennials. You know, someone on the bus asked, you know, what kind of a mortgage do you take out for this? It's not a home.
Yeah.
It's not a
home loan.
Right. So what Hank said is that you would take any money you have for a mortgage and build this bus instead.
Yeah, your 20% perhaps. I mean, this is his final project. How long was he working on this?
It's really amazing. It's only been about 4 months since Hank bought the bus. I mean, what he started with was literally an old, rusty school bus. And he's made something really impressive in just a short period of time. You know, when I asked him about obstacles he faced with the project, he mentioned something I think a lot of us can relate to.
The biggest obstacle was Minnesota. Winter lasted far too long, and a number of times it actually prevented me from moving forward. One of the first steps was to strip out the interior and get the rust off of the floor, and then paint it to prevent rust from forming again. And I couldn't get the bus above freezing to paint it. So I had to sit on my thumbs for a while and wait for that to happen.
Okay, so Hank just graduated, actually, this last weekend. So congrats, Hank. The bus is still on campus, Chrissy. So what happens to the bus now?
Yeah, this is a tricky question for Hank. He's going to have to move his bus from Rapson Hall soon. He's graduated and is no longer a student, so that's not a viable option. No one at the school's really given him an eviction notice yet, but he says the bus will probably float around the cities over the summer while he continues to work on it. So, you know, keep an eye out for this gray bus. he says his goal is to have the bus parked on property his grandfather owns in Wisconsin before the winter comes. That was really the inspiration for the project. Hank's grandfather owns 80 acres of land north of the Wisconsin Dells. And Hank said he's been trying to figure out a way to get a cabin on the property for years. And this is the grandfather who's loaning him the money.
Right. Now, you also said when they were all there, they had the big visit. There were professors. There were professional architects there. We heard a little bit of that back and forth earlier. But overall, I mean, what did people think of Hank's bus house thing?
The bus house thing was well received, Tom. Everyone was really impressed. You could tell that it was sort of the attention getter of the day. A bunch of graduate students were presenting their final projects. And as you might guess, Hank's bus attracted a crowd.
Stole the show, probably.
Indeed. I mean, the project actually won the 2013 Richard Morrill Award, which is the Critics' Choice. I think Hank's advisor, Adam Marcus, who's a design fellow at the School of Architecture, summed it up really well.
For me, the project is about practice. It's not, I mean, it's about design through making, but it's about your practice, and it's about where you're going next. And that, in my mind, you know, it's a terrific thesis project in that way, because it really is where you're going next. You're going to open a shop and all that. And so I think the power of the project is that even though he didn't present the kind of history of mobile architecture or prefabrication or mass customization, digital fabrication, all that came out of it in the presentation. And so it's been, you know, I set up the premise of full scale. You guys.
I saw that, I'm like, they don't know what's coming.
I said, we're going to do full scale. And Hank says, I'm going to buy a bus. And I said, go for it. And so I commend you for taking that premise, you know, literally, quite literally. And thank you. Enjoy this bus.
Every day I get the queue to get on the bus that takes me to you. I'm so nervous, I just sit and smile. Only another month.
Check out the photos of Hank and the bus on the Daily Circuit website. We also learned about Hank because of a previous show we did here on the Daily Circuit about tiny houses and the tiny house movement, so we've linked to that show as well. Thanks so much, Chrissy.
You're welcome.
So head to nprnews.org, continue the conversation we had previously here with Charles Mann from Amherst, Massachusetts. We were talking about oil, that conversation also at the Daily Circuit page. Next hour, you're going to hear the conversation I had earlier this week with John Grotzinger. He gets to work on the Mars Curiosity rover every day. He was in town for an event at the Fitzgerald Theater called Science Night, Minnesota. We're going to bring you that conversation next hour.
I want it. Threepence and sixpence every day, just to drive to my baby. Threepence and sixpence each day, 'cause I drive.